Good morning, everybody. Today is Tuesday, August 6, 2019. It's 9 o'clock a.m., and we're gathered for a general discussion of the Board of County Commissioners Conference Room. The first item on the agenda is Community Development Quarterly Update, and we have Mark Stevenson, our director, here.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you today?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm going to spread a little information around here for you. That's just kind of a...
Whoa, papers.
Yeah, lots of information. I won't bother you with all of it, but...
Some of it will be for fun reading.
Some of it will be there. And I didn't bring myself a copy. That's awesome.
He did not?
No.
Go ahead. Here, let's...
Annette, right? If you could just photocopy that. That would be great.
Okay. Thanks.
No, that's... I'm good there.
All right. Based on that, I'm getting my reading glasses.
Okay.
No crime was committed.
Ah, I found mine. Look at that.
Ah!
Turn it
over.
Turn it over.
It's been found.
We could use another cop.
So,
okay, so,
always five.
Always five. Well, I did four. I just have one hidden. Thank you so much.
So our staff gets one for the record, and then we each get one. So there's four just for us.
Okay.
And then for you, if you want one, five.
Okay. Okay, so our quarterly update for this August 6th, and this would be from May 1st to July 1st. Our accomplishments over at community development, as you well know, we've expanded our hours for better customer service. We most recently made a policy change on development permits. We're allowing up to 90 days for simple changes requested by the applicant. The existing policy was a new permit was required. Period. $300 for that permit, and I thought that was not a good way to go, considering some people just have a little change of heart. They might want a half bath in it, and they want to come back to us. And I don't believe it's fair to just 2 days later say, oh, you need another development permit for that. So we have a 90 days. They can come back, modify their permit within reason, and add no cost to them.
Nice.
So.
I was thinking about the attached garage versus detached garage, and sometimes that kind of comes up too. Is that considered simple, or is that considered an additional permit?
If they, if they took a detached garage and suddenly said, we decided to make it attached, that would be... I think that would fall within those 90 days. Yeah, you can change that. But if they came back and said, we have a development permit for a house and we've now decided to add a garage, that's going to take a separate development permit and review for that.
If they add it to the structure, I think what you're asking, if they add it to the structure...
I was trying to remember all the things that Valerian Homes was bringing up, different stuff, and one of them was a detached garage they brought up, remember?
Right, but if you had a detached garage... It was different, but if you were going to add it to the house with a concurrent roof line,
right? So that would be
considered part of the dwelling.
Yes,
but if you actually have one away from 50 feet away or whatever.
Oh yeah, that conversation was, even though it's the same roof line, they were considering it two different structures.
Right.
It's like no.
If it had a breezeway, it was considered a detached garage, but if it had the same roof line, it was one dwelling. Could be one dwelling.
So, you know what? I didn't put this in here because it was quite a while ago I changed that policy. So, you know how you have, with the zoning on the property, you can have your dwelling, then you have accessory to your dwelling.
Mm-hmm.
And everything is based on square footage. So, you can go up to roughly 6,000 extra square feet of accessory structures. Well, policy... per se, and the office has been, well, you would count that attached garage and breezeway, maybe an outdoor living space, as accessory to the living space. I don't see it that way. I see it as being part of the living space.
Right.
So if you have an attached garage, sometimes you'll have laundry, sometimes you'll have pantry. It's all part of the dwelling itself, in my opinion. So that's opened up an opportunity for people to have more accessory square
footage. So then they can have a shop or a shed or something like that.
Right. And this came from a gentleman here that had a home on the river. We were looking at, he wanted to do some outdoor living. He wanted to do an addition onto the back porch to get a little bit of sunblock to the back of the house. He already had a couple garages, but he also had a very large attached garage on his house. So he was exceeding the limits. And it just didn't seem reasonable to say that that attached 3 or 4 car garage was not part of the house. He had his laundry room out there. It was an enclosed laundry room, but his laundry room was out there. They had a full pantry out there. Had lots of storage, lots of things going on in that garage. And I seen it as, no, that's part of the dwelling. That's part of their daily use all day long.
But are we using the roof line as being that litmus test?
Yes. Yes.
That was what I found with one of the ones that was brought to me. It's you look at the house, you see one house. There's one roof line from right to left. And yet they were counting that as, because I guess there was a breezeway underneath the roof line between the garage and the house.
Right.
And,
frankly, planning was counting the square footage of your covered porch in that accessory structure. Mm-hmm. I don't see that as an accessory to the dwelling. I see a part of the dwelling is what you use. Accessory would be a separate shop out back that you just use.
Right.
You know, for your
as its own driveway to let in.
So I appreciate that you made the simple changes. And the detached garage, if they added one, that wouldn't be the full permit. It'd be that half rate in that time frame too, right, that you made those changes already?
If you if you build a house with an attached garage, that's just one development permit. It's the whole
structure. No, I know, but remember how you're saying if they wanted to come back and say,
decided
to add that shop or that thing on...
It would be the discounted price on the development permit. Correct, yes. So we've gone through the code enforcement policies and procedures. We're done there. I've been reviewing and updating other minor existing policies that we have. There's a large binder of policies from 1994, all the way up. So I've just been reviewing those and modifying it or tossing them out. They're not relevant anymore. Our 90-day IGA with Curry County is complete. We provide a field inspector to them for a couple weeks and assisted in structural and mechanical inspections. We completed 27 plan reviews for them. We did training on plan review. We're still assisting them in some respect. And I've provided the building official oversight, but they're pretty much up and going and doing very well over there. I would, at some point, would like to look at having a full IGA with Curry County to assist them as needed. Same way we have an IGA with City of Grants Pass.
So I'm curious, other departments have different IGAs between different counties and such, that kind of like emergency management has one statewide.
Mm-hmm.
And then regionally we have kind of a regional thing separately. Is there something like that with developers or building plan that you guys do things beyond just neighboring county and on a one-off? Is there anything that as an association you guys look at statewide or?
Not that I know of.
Okay.
It would be great if we could have a regional IGA. But it seems, I believe, statute's going to require that we have individual IGAs with jurisdictions.
Each entity.
Right
now
we're doing it as needed, rather than there being a organization that you're all involved in. But if Curry says, hey, we want an IGA with you, but Jackson doesn't, instead of everybody being in this organization, you
cooperative
agreement. Just do it as needed.
Yeah, so right now it's just individual, and it would be good for us to be able to continue working with Curry as they see the need.
I think it's
they don't
a great
have a lot of inspections, so I doubt. I mean, we have one with the City of Grants Pass, and we literally do nothing with them. Right. But we're there.
Something catastrophic happened.
And if something were to change in our dynamic and we need them, that idea comes in handy for us.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Well, and I like tying the knot a little closer with Curry. We've got an opportunity here with Julie heading over there.
Right, I agree.
To totally stay agree. Good friends.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I don't know. I'm still...
a little burnt?
Pirating.
It's that whole Navy Marines thing, you know? Yeah,
it is. Yes. We've guarded our gates for years. We haven't lost
Commissioner
one yet.
Pash. And...
I love it.
Yeah, but where would I be without Julie going over there?
Yeah, well, it's okay. It's a court voice thing. We banter back and forth with court, I think, more than anybody else. But.
So goals for next quarter, we're going to develop and explore the possibility of opening a satellite office in Cave Junction for county services, building safety planning and public health, and some possibly code enforcement. So we're just having a discussion right now.
I think we need to have a bigger discussion than just one department finding space out there. I know public health had to continue when we got rid of the county building, but I think it might... Commissioner DeYoung and I were very intentional 2 years ago when we came in to trust our senior commissioner and take information that was like, okay, yeah, you've been doing this for how many years before us, 6 years before us, so we're going to trust and go along. And one of the first things that we were told is we have to sell the county building. And the whole community is on board. We've been doing educational things. We've been doing meetings out there. And we agreed to sell it, and the community felt like we pulled the rug out from underneath them. And
I don't think they were up to speed.
No, and here we have consequences of we lost meeting space, we lost office space and various things like that. And I am concerned if we're going to have a bunch of departments having little separate places around, and so I'd like there to be coordination between...
Sure.
So we have Sheriff's Office and Community Corrections in the basement of City Hall. I don't think it's appropriate for WIC to go over there, but they're renting space from the community senior center over on River Street. And so it would be nice if that could be coordinated, that we look at does the county need kind of like a South Branch for all county services?
I think they just look at it comprehensively as what
and that may be something bigger than just
we'd like
a department.
To put out there and then find a location to do that.
To fit it, yeah, and that's I think the conversation started with you and Michael Weber, and so I don't know who else wants to be included, if that's the sheriff,
well,
because WIC is under public health, so.
Yeah, I think if there's looking at that we're looking for space out there, I don't think it's appropriate for departments to just go find space.
Right.
It needs to come before the commissioners.
Yep. Okay.
Yeah.
Helene, as our property manager, needs to be a part of that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
If there's space that needs to be found and leases and different stuff that goes through legal.
Do we know if we have any?
We don't know
any
out
there?
Currently.
County property? I don't think so.
No, county structures.
No, the building at the corner of...
You have something in Kirby, right?
We've got the Kirby shop for staging and whatnot. Obviously, yeah. Oh.
That's true. And I had heard... Who actually owns the museum?
Don't look at me.
I've been trying to find that out. It's an interesting question.
Is that on the same property?
It's adjacent, I think.
Adjacent.
Or it's one off.
Adjacent to it.
Yeah.
If you look at our GIS system.
Because we used to, the county used to own it. It used to be the Josephine County Kirbyville Museum was owned by the county.
Hmm.
Because 50 years ago, I put air conditioning on there and it came through this building.
Hmm.
But I don't know.
If it's still.
In the downturn, for instance, the library, we just gave up the libraries and to the library district.
Right.
We don't have a library out there. We don't have a library out there. The library district does. Now, I don't know what happened to that museum. It is open.
Mm-hmm.
I was just wondering what happened to all the artifacts in it, if maybe that was some place that the smoke jumpers could have a wing in there if they decided to ever move out of the airport out there. But there's some historical society, I guess, that runs it. I could never find out.
I did reach out to Michael Weber also and suggest that maybe we look at a grant in order to maybe fund a infrastructure out there. Because there is some, there's quite a bit of cost for us to, just my department thinking of being out there, you know.
Well, you'd need an office and a space at the counter.
Correct.
You don't need the whole building, more, I think public health would need more of, you know, we need, as you say,
probably more private offices and things like that.
Yeah, but honestly, maybe not 40 hours a week.
But does City Hall, who has counter space and office space, have extra? Is it something you co-locate with their planning department in the city?
Yeah.
We've had some pushback on that.
Okay.
Limited
space. That's what we were told.
No, it's worth asking. It's not necessarily a guarantee, but
that's why we kind of step back and are looking at it holistically, like you said, not just what building and planning might need, but we're starting to broaden that out so we can have a better question.
Well, it's amazing. Too bad we didn't have a perfectly centered county building right in downtown Cape Junction with office space and meeting space available for all of our needs.
Well, so you're referring to kind of like the old bank building down here between 6 and 7, which would be the most perfect spot
for development.
But don't miss a chance.
I digress.
So the Kirbyville Museum is owned by the Kirbyville Museum Board of Directors.
Okay, so we're going to start within our department, figuring out would we need more staff, how many hours would we want to be out there, how does that relate to the amount of permits that we do issue at this time and the amount of inspections that we do. And a little further down, I'll get into the amount of inspections we're doing, which we are way up for building safety. But one thing we're working through right now is text amendments. Some of it's just housekeeping stuff in our code, clearing up a few things in there, and then a couple unintentional issues between state statute and what we had in our code. We're just dialing that, cleaning that up. That was specifically for hardship, home hardship, and having a a temporary dwelling on the property. Looking at developing and implementing a policy for VRBOs and Airbnbs, and if you take a look at page 1 basically and page 2 talks about a dwelling should not be used as a rental for vacation or resort occupancy unless approved under other provisions of this title. So a very simple text amendment we can do is on that front page. Number 5, bed and breakfast stands, we can add Airbnb, vacation rental. They're subject to specific standards as far as how many people can be there at any one time and such. And then adding a vacation rental by owner, VRBO, vacation rental for less than 30 days. And we can do this within just a simple text amendment. And we can add it to what we're already working on. Very simple. So if you want to have an Airbnb, a vacation rental, a bed and breakfast, and or a VRBO, there's a path to do that through the home occupation.
Why not just take the dwelling definition and remove that line? That line, is that an official state definition? Or is that something we internally did to create a policy?
No, that was done internally.
Simply can be striped from that policy. Because that's not a state. We've talked about not wanting our standards stricter than state law unless there's a specific, that we're not trying to make it harder for things. Well, but to say a dwelling shall not be used as a rental for vacation or resort occupancy unless approved by other provisions of this title.
Correct.
Why is that in the definition?
Well, it's there in the definition in order to direct people to a home occupation. Otherwise, there's no standard.
Is that a change or has that been there all along? Because you have red line on the first page. This has
been here, but I'm not sure how long that was.
And I'm not sure.
I believe it was changed recently.
Okay.
When we codified this code 2 years ago.
I don't recall that being something that we talked about.
I believe
2 years
that
ago.
was put in there, but I'd have to go back to older codes.
Here's a concern that I have. I was just having a conversation with someone the other day about policies and departments, and individual departments setting up their own policies without it going through the board. Mm-hmm. That at some point we may be having policies that the board wouldn't endorse or support.
Mm-hmm.
One that we need to get cleaned up, for instance, in code enforcement, is they're taking enforcement action on kennels. yet the county is not currently issuing kennel licenses. Mm-hmm. So how are we taking action against something in the code when we're not giving them a path to legal remedy? Mm-hmm. And so if we're not issuing codes, matter of fact, someone turned in a check for a kennel and was returned the check by the county, and then right. action was taken against for a kennel. That's a concern of mine, that we're taking action.
Why would you be concerned about something like that?
I know.
Well, we don't do licensing on kennels, but we have...
The county does.
As far as community development and planning, we go through basically home occupation.
This is a concern of mine, and kennels are limited. Individual policies within different departments that are not necessarily coordinating, that kennels are inspected by the ACOs, which are under sheriff. They're licensed through the health department after a permitting process with community development. Yet, at some point in the last 10, 15 years, some of those processes stop. So someone will turn an application in and a check, and we're returning it to those applicants. Yet, code enforcement is now taking action against people for not having kennels, including people who've written checks to try
Let me say,
code enforcement should not be involved in kennels unless it's a land use violation for a kennel.
Code enforcement is taking action against a current kennel person who has previously put in an application and can show the check that was returned.
Okay.
And so their concern as an individual is, why are you taking enforcement on something you don't have a legal path to an outcome?
Well, you also don't have the authority within community development to go outside the box.
But community development said it's in the code, so therefore we're going to enforce it. But we're not, as a county, enforcing the portion that gives them the legal path to licensing. So right. it's been in the code that we would enforce and inspect kennels. That's been in the code. But at some point, they stopped issuing those licenses and stopped inspecting them. And with us bringing code enforcement back, code enforcement started enforcing without finding out that we're not issuing licenses for them to be legitimate in the first place. I'm just saying that I remember disagreeing with Commissioner Hare one time when he said...
One time?
Once. It was this one time, so it was memorable. Community corrections is law enforcement, and therefore you have law enforcement certification. So when the director retired and the new director wasn't starting for a couple weeks, there was a lapse of time that there was nobody in charge, per se, from the county's perspective of the department. And Commissioner Hare's perspective is the commissioners were in charge at that time. Internally, the department, knowing that officers are certified through the state and have different projects, we would determine internally who was kind of that next in command. But it's a separation between which policies do the commissioners oversee and endorse, which ones are just internal to departments, which ones are... It's part of a structure that at some point we should probably have a conversation of, department by department, and part of the COOP. Who's the chain of the continuation of operations, the this and that. But these policies, you know, as far as... It was why when I heard you wanted to bring VRBOs and it's not in the code, it's not allowed, it's like, well, hold on. Is that something we would even endorse? And do we want a path to endorsement that gives... My opinion for 2.5 years has been, if you have a business on residential... You have a home occupation permit. If we got to change what it's called to make it fit, because you're not occupying your home, I don't care what we call it. But essentially, you have a business permit for operating a business within a residential zone.
Right, and that's where, you know, a simple one line within our code directs people to that path.
But it looks at the impact within the neighbors so that it's a legal path to get someplace. Correct. So instead of telling everybody you can't have a business on your residence, it says, okay, if you're going to have a business... Let's mitigate how you impact your neighbors.
So kennels are regulated through the zoning and planning department, and part of that is specifically for barking in neighborhoods and how that's controlled. But once we issue a development permit for a kennel, we're hands off. Now, if there's someone else that has to get involved with
the
kennel,
two other departments.
We've approved it for a kennel.
Yeah.
And it goes out the door. Now, what other departments do as far as the licensing or the health issues with that, I would assume that if they were up and active, then we're gonna look for responses from those departments. But for them to just drop it. I don't have an answer why they did that, but I do know this. Code enforcement is stepping outside the box if they're looking at licensing or any of that, because that has nothing to do with
community
development.
And maybe they were looking at the enforcement of the land use, that there wasn't a permit or something like that.
The land
use
is what we do.
But there has not been a process for someone to acquire a permit either, because in the permit requirement, they have to have the stuff from the county as well. Mm-hmm. And so, the other departments as well. And it's one of those things that it makes me just wonder. The only reason I bring it up is because where's the coordination of policies within departments? Mm-hmm. If one department has a policy in going this route, is it in consistency with another department, or is it in conflict with another department? Where's the tie that brings them together? And just so happened we had an advisory meeting on Thursday night that brought up a situation that we have multiple departments involved, three departments involved, and somebody who tried to go a legal path to get something done couldn't, and then has enforcement taken against them because they didn't go the legal path. And so how do we make sure that in our policy enforcement and creation there's a consistency and a coordination, if that makes sense?
No, it does. Totally makes sense. So we already do that with so much of the department. As far as building a structure, you get a development permit, you have to go to building safety, you also have to reach out to a state agency, DEQ, and have their approval prior to that permit being issued. So I'll definitely look into kennels and how that process is, and I'll reach out to, is it through public health that used to, I guess, regulate kennels?
And ACOs, so which are now under sheriff, which is one of the issues that is why it's convoluted, because three different departments are involved in the process.
Then I'll need to.
I don't mind three different departments, but they all should follow the same policy. They should all be dealing with the same set of rules, whether it comes from public health, ACOs, or sheriff, or whoever.
And you have, just in like this anything, case, you have a long-term kennel that had been licensed for years and years and years, and then at some point the licenses stopped being renewed. Since the application, since the check.
Who did they have the license with? With the county?
Public health. County.
With public health. And the public health, they came in to renew their license. We don't do that anymore?
Yep. And even return the application and the check. And
then
code enforcement.
Then we put it into.
Okay, fine. But code enforcement is now taking action because a neighbor made a complaint about a kennel. Yeah. And so I just want to make sure that our policies are consistent and working together.
Sure. Mark, why don't you dig into that and see what you come up with on that.
But in the VRBO one, I just was curious about the language about the dwelling shall not be used as a rental for vacation. Is that language we want in a definition of what a dwelling is?
Right. That may have, that has to change if you're going to let this.
Well, it says if you follow other procedures.
Right, unless approved under other provisions in this title.
I believe this was, that definition was modified when we codified the code, the most recent, and the reason being was the lack of rentals and residential structures here in Josephine County, and the emergency order, and the, and that was to say, okay, you can't just take every single residence and turn it into, you know, whatever you want to rent out of it, you know, and rent it on a weekly basis without going through a process of a home occupation. If that definition was modified, I don't know how we would. I mean, that it's pretty clear as far as enforcement goes. We say, yes, you can do it. You can do a VRBO. You can do an Airbnb. You can do a bed and breakfast. You can just rent rooms, however you want to do it. But you need to go through a home occupation.
And a level three.
And the home occupation is to notify neighbors, to let them know what's going on, and see what the impact in that neighborhood is. Maybe.
Is that why it's a level 3?
Yes.
And that's the highest level of the home.
Well, you could go type 2 or 3, but I'm not sure when bed and breakfast came into a level 3. But it's been in the code since 1994 at the very.
But that's what I'm wondering. Why are they at the highest level with large manufacturing and hazardous material when.
It's outside the scope of 1 and 2 as far as what they do with the Airbnb and VRBO, but I can look into it. The process for a Type 2 is basically the same as a 3. You still make notice to property owners. You still wait for comment from departments and property owners before a decision is made. A type 2 is less expensive. So the type 3 is a $2,000 fee to go through that process. Type 2 is a $600 fee. So I can look at how
that can be
changed.
What do you guys think? Should it be on the same as a hazardous material?
Well, no. I don't believe that. I'm just saying that.
Tourism is a hazardous fun. What do they do at Sun River? What do they do at Olivia Beach up in,
Lincoln
these
County,
things are
Tilden
all
County.
Over the place.
Yeah. What do the other counties do?
Those are, when you talk Sun River, that's a CCNR. It's an agreement within the resort that if you build within that resort, you will make it, available to as an Airbnb and as a vacation rental. But I can look into,
So there's no
Jackson's
permanent
doing.
Residence in Sun River, Oregon?
Oh, yeah.
There are.
Oh, yeah. Mm. Yeah, there are.
But you just said as part
of
the
some of those areas that have the CCNR, so there's little duplexes in there and what have you, and they're left up for a certain number of rentals.
Well, I appreciate you bringing this to us, that we at least, I question that it should be in the same category as a large-scale manufacturing and business operation requiring hazardous waste.
Well, I'll do some research on that and find out why. That's the biggest thing. Is it under a statute, a rule? Where did it come from?
Every time I ask Julie about the home occupation stuff, it doesn't fit under a 1 or a 2. We'll change it to be what we need it to be with levels that make sense.
Mm-hmm.
But to compare somebody renting a house out for the weekend to someone who's got a large manufacturing product on their property, it seems to be not apples to apples.
Processing CBD oil.
Really. Not going to happen.
And while you're at it, Mark, I don't like having those private names in our code unless they're in parentheses like...
No, it needs to be such as.
Yeah, such as. Because we don't want to, say Uber and
no,
say,
I,
yeah,
I
Lyft,
totally
say
agree.
No, yeah, ride sharing
I've said that
or whatever.
All along. So,
okay,
yeah.
Great.
There should be.
Yeah, there should just be an example or whatever.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I do appreciate you looking at options. And honestly, the whole home occupation thing, why is it called home occupation versus residential business permit? Or something like that, because not everybody is having the business in the home they're occupying. It might be in a secondary dwelling on the property or a secondary structure, but it's still a business on a residential property.
Right.
And so looking at that and the reasonableness of what our language is versus what's actually happening and what makes sense, it all goes down to the zoning is residential and how are you impacting neighbors. And... if you're renting out and there's 30 people that show up, that might have a bigger impact than renting out and one person shows up in a house for the weekend. So there could be different levels and categories.
Right, so when you look at home occupation, you have type 1, 2, and 3, and type 1 limits you to, 8 to 5 with only a few deliveries during the week. It has to come like parcel post. You can't have large semis pulling into your yard and things like that. Type 2 takes it up a little bit. You could have more employees on the property, more items of your business out on the property itself. And type 3 even takes it further than that. How bed and breakfast got into a type 3? You got me wondering.
It might have been because of the amount of cars you could have parked there. I know when we went up to Olivia Beach, you had 3 cars.
Mm-hmm.
That was it.
Yeah.
You better figure out, I don't care if you had 20 people staying in the house, you only have place for 3 cars.
So there's...
The couple of the Airbnbs around here, and they have their weddings or whatever, and then the whole neighborhood packed with cars. Mm-hmm. That maybe is what brought them into the level of manufacturing.
Well, we also, in a type 2 and a 3, we have the option, director has the option to have conditions on that particular permit. So... I've been thinking about this a lot. I had a gentleman that had a meeting with me several weeks ago, and his issue was his neighbor has a VRBO in the home. There's no fences between the properties, river property. And every time he seems to be in the hot tub with his wife, he's got strangers looking down from the upper deck, and then other people sometimes just walking down on the property.
It's all the same park.
Yeah, exactly. And it's like, are they with the house or not with the house? Are they
bringing their wine glasses over to the hot tub?
Exactly.
So on that, though.
So it would be nice to have some means by which a person could reach out. And I've seen this before on VRBOs where they'll have a sign that says, for information, contact, for neighborhoods to actually contact the owner or whoever's running the VRBO and say, hey, there's like 20 people here and they're wandering my property. But it'd also be nice if there's a means of letting neighbors know that, hey, for the next 2 weeks, you're going to have a party of 12 hanging out next to your house. I don't know. I don't know how it will work. But it's definitely something to explore.
I appreciate exploring it, but I don't think we should be reinventing the wheel.
No.
There are plenty of counties that have this going on that we should look what the counties are doing versus cities.
Yeah.
Lincoln County, and I can never remember Astoria's county's name, but they have a lot of them. But Tillamook,
and that's one
Lincoln,
where I've seen the signs, up on in the front of them where you could contact them.
Well, and I just went to a wedding down in California, and it was an hour from Tahoe, and everything in the neighborhood was a vacation rental.
Yeah.
And there was different signs in the house about restrictions of this and that, and do this and that. So it shouldn't be that we're reinventing the wheel or trying to make something fit for just us when this is something that lots of other people are doing.
Sure. And we should find a path to make it happen, too.
So that when we get our lodging tax in.
We have very spotty instances where, for instance, you're going to have a bed and breakfast or whatever right in the middle of a residential thing. That's the only one there. Mm-hmm. Whereas a lot of these places, they're all vacation rentals, so everybody kind of gets along. We had a couple of party houses up there to Olivia Beach, and the cops were on it just like that and quiet it down. Everybody taps was at 10 o'clock, and everybody's quiet. Yeah, I think because we have such limited instances of this, it's going to be tough because you've got a neighbor on each side that live there.
Right.
And right in the middle of it is this vacation. People rent that. You get a
college
fraternity
in
there, and you're going to be you're going to have an issue with your neighbors. I guarantee it.
Right. And putting out notice to the neighbors to get their feedback on that. It's possible at times we can have some conditions there that meets everybody's needs within that neighborhood and still allows people to do what they want with their property. So, if I may, I'll move on. I'm going to continue reviewing existing policies and procedures. I'm also looking at new policies and procedures for oversight on mass gatherings. I've had a problem with mass gatherings for a long time. It used to be just a signature card, and there you go have your party. We're finding that things can get out of hand with that. I also have, as building official, I have large concerns with electrical that goes on to the sites and stages, aluminum stages and electrical cords and all these things that are going on. So on the building safety side, there's a means as building official where I can require a licensed electrician to be on site during all the connections and all, and we can also do electrical inspections with that contractor to confirm that everything is in safe order before people jump up on an aluminum stage, start dancing, and wind up getting zapped or something. Also, just the structure of a stage itself.
You mean you're not in favor of aluminum hard hats?
No.
Are you sure?
So, Public Works has reached out to me also, and not Rob necessarily, but and would like to have eyes on the site, or what they're telling us exactly what they're doing out there and when does this start. Also, some timelines. They're coming a little too quick. It's like, we're having it on Friday and we're not issuing the development permit till Thursday. We know that things are already getting set up, so we need to put some timelines there,
I thought we already had time frames in place.
There's nothing that I've seen that really is straightforward.
Saying it has to be a week
ahead. But that's not what we were told with that one out in Williams. We were told that they needed at least 2 weeks before they applied. We were told there were very specific timelines involved, and that's why it is.
It's, you know, there's that minimum 2 weeks. The problem is you apply and you may not get your permit for 10, 12 days out of a 14-day period. Next thing, now we're really pushed, and the clients are pushed. They're pushed to, we just got our permit, but they're already setting up. So we just need to be able to review what they're doing and get them set up properly and make sure we're on site for electrical. And
right, and start including that requirement in your application for the electrical permit.
And, right. And make sure that we're good to go. The other thing is that there are means by which you can enforce those timelines, 10 o'clock, you know, 10 o'clock at night, however.
Noise whatever, cut off.
Whatever they are, and that's through the electrical safety law. So, and that can be written into those policies. I would assume that the board would want me to bring that policy and procedure to you as far as what we do in mass gatherings for review. So I'll make sure that you're on board
There's one of us that would understand the electrical part of it.
Yeah. Well, and the public should have...
If there's any mechanical, we'll make sure we're looking at that, too.
And the public should have a chance to look at it, too, as our unrolling of a change.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The other concern with that is a lot of these barns and such have exemptions from the building code, and the public is not allowed in those structures. It's one of the very specifics in the ORS. And so we want to make sure that people aren't just taking an existing exempt structure and throwing 700 people into that space.
Right, and so electrical and everything else.
Exiting, and, you know, hazards. So it's, you know, it's time that some clear policy procedures were made for mass gatherings.
Absolutely.
Especially if we're going to have these larger ones that we're seeing so often.
The folks out here, that all sounds real good to us in government, but to the folks out there, you're encroaching on their privacy. That's my barn.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, I stack hay in it, the hay's not in there, and I'm going to have a hoedown for my daughter's wedding. Mm-hmm. Then you want to come in, and because I've got more than 75 people, you want lighted exit signs, and you want fire suppression, and
the bottom line on an agricultural structure in the state of Oregon under the revised statute is you're not allowed to go in that building.
But that doesn't mean anything to the people that own the building. Well, they're going to have their wedding reception for their daughter.
Yeah.
So when we say, yeah, you can do that, except you're going to have to do this, 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 and this, and this, they're going to put all the stuff in here for a one-shot deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so that's, you know, they're going to look at it as overreach and encroaching on their private function. And when it all goes bad,
when the haystack catches on fire,
that's the concern. But, however, I'm just telling you that's the way they're going to look at it. We can all agree here that, yes, we need to protect everybody from themselves, but they're not going to see it that way.
But we also need to protect the public, because when you start inviting 100 people, you've gotten outside of the family, and now you've got a public health concern. And so somewhere in there it crosses the line from having all your family over for Easter and then having a wedding with 200 people.
You're inviting the public into a space that
it's not
potentially could be a life hazard.
Well, I went to a deal out, and it was in Jackson County. It wasn't here. It was in Jackson County, and the guy, once a year, he roasts a pig. And he has a bunch of people over in their barn, and there's an old guy that plays the guitar and sings.
Mm-hmm.
And there might be 300 people in that barn at one time, and then they wander out and get a plate full of food and go sit on some bales of hay and so on and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
That wouldn't be allowed.
Correct.
It would not be allowed. He's going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And if you show up there with the sheriff and the lights blazing and the fire department and everything, say, yes, we've got to break this all up, you're going to lose. But if it catches on fire and burns to the ground, I hope somebody doesn't say,
get blamed.
Why did you allow to do that? He would be liable, yes.
Yeah.
Exactly.
You know, Commissioner Fowler is well aware of the bullet we dodged down on a building that I had condemned in Murphy.
Oh, yeah.
And that building was just absolutely, if there was a fire, any kind of fire in that, we would have mass casualties in that building that
they were sleeping in tents.
That was already condemned, but still being
we do.
Used.
I mean, people are going to do what they're going to do, but and you know, I'm not for any more regulation than what we have, but we do have those in place for the safety of the public and mm-hmm. accessing those structures.
We need to move things along. Yeah. With our
so, anyway, I'll be looking at that. I'll bring that to the board. I need to revisit some fees for electrical, our electrical program, make sure we're consistent with other jurisdictions. Some of those may be lower, some of them may be a little higher. It just depends on the type of permit. But I'll bring that, obviously, I'll bring that to the board too. So the building division, from May until July, we've had 46 new single-family dwellings, 19
honestly,
additions.
Honestly, with timing, Mark, I apologize to interrupt. If you have something outside of just the typed-out stuff, we can read the numbers and stuff, but I am concerned about our timing.
Okay, so overall, we're doing really good in community development.
A lot more.
We're up across the board, staff.
And summary.
I want to make just a quick point, and that is in planning, they've dealt with an average of 70 counter contacts and phone contacts a day.
Wow.
And they're still well and above the time limit for issuing development permits.
Nice.
And if you haven't been getting the phone calls, then we're
we have
doing
not, yes.
Somebody's doing something right. So
great.
You
know,
and you're working on the code enforcement, chipping away, chipping away.
Yeah.
Yep. Since we just saw an article in the paper showing how far behind we are.
I did get it. I did have a marijuana grower in my office and was quite concerned about the hemp growers using groundwater and so on and so on. And I don't know what they're doing with their runoff and all of the nuance. I said, gee, that's the same thing I heard of from the common citizen when you moved in.
That's exactly
exact same thing.
You should know, I am working on some
right.
hemp issues.
Okay.
Especially as it pertains to the residential land. They need to meet their setbacks off the property lines and not be encroaching on those. I've had several contacts with neighbors said they're right up against the fence. They've literally bulldozed their whole front yard and planted hemp right up to the fence.
Do they?
Well, they still have to meet the development standards for residential
property.
Is there
a permit? Like, is there a licensing to be a hemp grower?
There is a registry number with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. And if they are not registered with them, then it is a legal marijuana crop. And that's quote-unquote from the Oregon Department of Agriculture.
And they don't have any enforcement either, so it's just...
Well, they do for those that have a registry number. So if we find...
Right, that's what I'm getting at. If you, have a, if you have a registry number, you have somebody watching over you.
Exactly.
But if you're illegal, that guy, you say, that guy right there doesn't have a number.
They're,
bust him, and he go, no, I'm here to take care of you.
Right.
Because you're
and what the Oregon Department of Agriculture told me is turn it to law enforcement to illegal marijuana crop.
Here, well,
that's what they said.
We're back to square one.
I don't know if I've told you yet, but I'm trying to put together a hemp summit for the 28th.
You mentioned
it. I did, yeah, and I got the state person coming down, and so that was the dictator of the date and time.
Mm-hmm. And that and same so, state person is who I've been in contact with.
All right.
So going back to them having enforcement of their own, registered people, when we find a property that is encroaching on all those property lines with their hemp grow, and they don't want to listen to us as far as you need to move your plants in, then we can go to the Oregon Department of Agriculture and make a complaint against that registered person. But as far as...
The registered person.
The registered person,
not
the other person.
The other guy.
The other crop. If it's not OLCC, it's not OHA, and they don't have a registry with ODA, it's a legal marijuana crop in the state of Oregon and should go directly to law enforcement. Now, will law enforcement do anything about it? I have no idea. But that is their, that is Oregon Department of Agriculture's take is if they're not registered,
that's what
it's
we
illegal
got a grant
marijuana.
To enforce those people that are not registered with here. Our grant from the Criminal Justice Commission was supposed to enforce those unlicensed.
So invite the sheriff to the summit.
Yeah, we don't have them hired. And I don't know that we got renewed on the grant. So the hiring struggles we've had has been a big part of that. So,
yep. Interesting to say. We'll see. Well, very good.
I would recommend for the wedding venues, for the mass gathering, for the BR&Bs, all that kind of stuff, we shouldn't be reinventing the wheel. Mm-hmm. We should look at what other counties are doing okay. and what regulations they've come up with to allow events to happen within a healthy manner.
Sure.
And that's really what our goal should be. Allow mm-hmm. the freedom of the use of the properties, but mitigate the impacts on the neighbors in a reasonable fashion.
Yeah, right. I'm always
and public safety.
finding a path.
When you ask that question, happen. Make sure you stress that's in a, like a residential neighborhood, and you have one bed and breakfast that wants to put on weddings and stuff. It's in, yeah. their neighbors are residents, not but a not
our
a
county
community.
Doesn't have farmlands like
not
other counties. We don't have the current, I mean,
right.
we have to allow on residential what other counties maybe don't have to because they have more diverse land use.
Correct.
But if you're talking, if you're going to call like Lincoln or Deschutes or somebody and say, what are they? They're going to say, well, out at Sun River we do this, or out at Olivia we do this, and over there we do this. But that's not.
No, we're looking
that's
at
not
the community itself.
Our,
yeah.
our problem is that it's in with residential.
Right, and when you talk about Sun River, it's a destination resort and zone that
right.
way. So they have really their own rules for that. So,
yeah.
Right.
I will do that.
Sounds good.
Thank Mark. You, sir.
Thank you.
Marvelous. Thank you.
All right, next up we have public works.
Let's skip our 1 o'clock, what do you say?
Yeah. yeah.
Since we did this.
Yeah.
With Rob Brandis, director, is present.
Morning, commissioners.
Good
morning, sir.
The big updates. There's the extra copy there. So, I'll start from the top and head on down, and you can flag me or throw something if you want to have deeper discussion. The first one there is a carryover. There has not been a whole lot of change yet for Finch. This, if you'll remember, we need to have work done on the bearings and joints, so we're going to contract this out this fall. That'll involve local contractor probably about a week, I'm guessing $20,000 to $25,000. That'll basically go out there and readjust those joints, clean the bearings, and effectively it's
going to be. Is Finch the one on a Kirby?
That's the big long one on the west side of 199 out there in the valley. The huge one that's, yeah,
okay.
300 gazillion feet long. Yeah, yeah. And our suspicion is we're never going to get HBP funding, just given the size and length and location of that. So it's back to, you know, what can we do to maintain it? I could see us, as I mentioned there, putting in for a rehab app, which we've actually never done, but that may be a more likely scenario. But, you know, rehab on a bridge like that could easily be $1 million by the time you're, you know, stripping it, repainting, all those kinds of things. And, I mean, to rebuild it, that's probably a $6-7 million bridge, and just for 400 cars a day, we're never going to get there. So we're back to maintenance on that one. Sand Creek's cranking along. Got a little scared a couple weeks ago as they were driving pile. They hit resistance way earlier than they thought. Didn't have depth, but they eventually went back and got it to depth. So that was a bullet dodged. Slabs, I believe, are coming down today, so they may even putting those in the next day or two. We got Jason out taking some photos because those are cool, exciting shots to get on the webpage. But Timber Mountain's hammering along on that, and I suspect they will be done mid-September. The Azalea Robertson Bridge, those are done. The big catch I wanted for the board on there was just that we're trying to now get an IGA for ODOT to maintain all of our flashers we have out there. When I say all, there's not that many. I've got a list at the end there, but they've got the personnel to do that. They've got, you know, electrical trucks that effectively can go out and take care of that stuff. It makes no sense for us to try and maintain that inventory or knowledge, but they sound like they're amenable to do it. It's just a matter of them coming up with the time to get an IGA.
If you're outbound on Robertson Bridge Road and get to Azalea, there's a huge berm right there on your right-hand side. Did we knock that down? Because you can't see up Azalea Drive.
On the northeast corner there.
I don't know which is northeast. I'm not yeah. out that. If I'm outbound from Merlin,
right,
and I get to Azalea Drive, I look to my right, and I'm looking at a granite bank that's
yep.
up high as that side.
We've laid it back as far as we can with the right-of-way. We could look at a construction easement to see if the owners there were okay with us knocking it back. I agree.
I mean, there's nothing out there on that tip of their property, and just say,
no.
hey, we want to knock that off of there for traffic safety. He'd probably like
right.
it because people aren't showing up on his porch banging on their door.
Right.
Trying to get the
can, I, can you call a tow a record for me? Yeah, we could look.
Do that?
We could look at getting some kind of an easement from him to do it. And
I'd love it.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
I think that, you know, if we can put up all the stuff, we spent $177,000 out there, and then you look up there and that, and you're looking at a dirt bank instead of being able to see lights coming
yeah.
outbound on Azalea. So that's, to me, that would be very important.
We can see about
okay,
it.
If you could look at that, I appreciate it.
Yeah. Okay. A long time painful intersection.
Yes, indeed. Kirby, we have not had a change yet, so this spring was the intended replant date, but as we looked at the weather, we said, it's getting a little scary here. We don't want to be in a situation where we were watering, and we ended up looking like geniuses because about a week after the seed was that fluky 100 degrees out of nowhere, so it would have been dusted. So looking at this fall, once the weather breaks, that'll just be cheaper and more effective, and we're not trucking water out to the pucker brush a couple times a week. Hamilton House, the demo was done on that. As you've probably heard, Helene has it up for sale now, and I believe it closes the 28th, I want to say, is the window. So
hopefully, that's the closed bid one, right?
Yep, yep. So hopefully we'll see a good number on that. And actually, the property immediately east of that is developing as well, so they may both end up kicking off in the next year or so, which would be, it's a good spot. You can get quite a few lots in there and kind of a logical tie to town. And the city pulling Overland Drive out of the TSP was kind of the final wrinkle to get that out of there. There's no way that was going to be a future connector, so it opened it up. The Galice Road project, we're kind of at a high water mark right now until this fall and the locates are done. We've got about 75% of the guardrail in. The rest ran into some utility conflicts, so we're on a holding pattern there. But Copeland got that larger pullout area below Stratton Creek paved. It's been a month plus, but that's been getting hammered if you drive by there. A lot of people using that for pullout, kind of a reconnect spot. And our guys got the three turnouts in the Indian Marriott all chip sealed within the last week or two. So the dust is settling out there on that one, with the exception of this fall. This next one, the arts project, is pretty cool. So I think I've talked about this one with all three of you. This was ODOT kind of did a systemic safety project where they wanted to identify corridors that weren't well enough marked with curve riders, chevrons, those kinds of things. And they basically said, here's how much it would cost us to get those done. Well, we went and took it in-house and got it done. We've banged out all nine roads that they had on the initial list, and we've got two-thirds of that money still left on the table. So our next step now is to say, look, we want to go all the way down that list you initially had. They kind of put a first kind of golf tournament cut line. Hey, we think you can get to here, but we're saying we're going to go as far down the list till we spend the full $254.
If we have money to do more, let's do the more.
The other thought we had was to potentially look at doing the design work for all the ADA ramps that we were conditioned to do on the Lower River Road Exchange. You remember there's about 28 wheelchair ramps that they conditioned us to do as part of accepting that road. So if we can't spend it there, we may look at putting it on those as well, which could qualify. But yeah,
clarify that for me.
Yeah.
What do we need a wheelchair ramp on Lower River Road for?
On this close into town, there are a half dozen roads that have them.
On this
that are city they, street
and
style.
And they don't make spec where they don't have
them. Lane.
Right. Exactly.
And Schaefer. And as part of that bigger state agreement, ODOT had to agree to have them all replaced by, I want to say, 2028. So by inheriting Lower River Road, we effectively inherited that. It worked out good because as part of that exchange, I want to say that they gave us $14,000 per ramp to fix, which, short of getting fully federalized and everything else, will do them for quite a bit less.
Let it settle in for a while, because I noticed that, for instance, like that flint blinking light over here on E Street, that was $15,000, and then as they put in more blinking lights, the price goes down. Now they're like $4,000 again.
Yeah, yeah. Ramps have calmed down quite a bit.
And the ramps will calm down when guys get the forms made and how to put them in, and so they don't get callbacks and so on and so forth. So if we've got till 2028, let's let that relax a little bit, and then pick a time when it's, because there's cement, do them all year long.
And what we may end up doing is
some in the wintertime.
If we can't spend that money on additional signage, it's potentially just doing the design for those and then just hold the design till whenever, leave it in the can, and we've got it ready to go.
Okay.
So the major culvert installations, the last three worked out great. They got Jump Off Joe and Winona knocked out in 4 days each, so I sympathize with those folks. That was a long go-around, but they got it done as quickly as they could. Those both had a performance bonus of, I think, $1,500 a day, but if that got it done without carrying over another long weekend, to me, that's money very well spent. And they came in under budget by a ways. The next three we're now looking at are out on Reeves Creek Road, and these are all, it's effectively six culverts. They're all double barrel, but if you're familiar with Reeves Creeks, it's a nightmare. That creek just twists and turns back and forth over that road, and there's a large section there that's just impacted with culvert after culvert after culvert. So all three of those are going, and if you're going to fix them, you might as well fix them all, because it's far enough out there that makes no sense to do. Yeah, do two at a time, right? And one other I didn't put on here at the construction season, you'll be seeing Thursday, the Azalea overlay is coming in. That's our next kind of loop in that Merlin Road, Azalea Upper River Road loop. We got fantastic numbers on that. We're doing about a mile or two from Robertson Bridge down to U Creek. And we had that coming in at probably 5.25, and it came in at 4.23, I believe. Copeland and Knife River were within about 15,000 of each other. So that was very cool. Good news on that one.
Now, I have a question.
Yeah.
As we, I'm looking at 4.25 versus 2.96, so that's $1.25.
Yep.
$1.30.
Yep.
And then you just talked about Azalea Drive being 100 under. Is there, instead of just putting that money away, can we move that up onto Beacon and go to the freeway instead of just the Quail Crossing? I mean, is that money we could move into something, into a different project, or do you just keep that in road reserve?
It's effectively in road reserve.
In the road reserve.
Yeah.
Okay,
the Azalea one would be slightly different because that is actually money that's our annual, that STP money that we have to use to reimburse overlays or chip seals. So in that case, that money actually rolls over. So we would just have $100,000. We roll over to next year's asphalt and chip sealing. And it would just continue that next loop. So we'd probably put $100,000 additional overlay on Azalea on the next loop of that. Yeah.
Okay. But otherwise, well, I just wonder if there's an opportunity there to continue on with Beacon. And eventually, if we get Beacon within reason, we'll do an exchange with the city of Grants Pass, and we don't have to finish the rest of it.
Yeah, if we can convince them to take
it. If we get it close enough to say, hey, we've done our half.
I'm game.
We've done our half, and the other top half is yours.
But to your bigger question, that's all kind of road and bridge reserve. So if it's $100,000 saved there, it effectively means that's $100,000 you could put towards
Beacon getting done. I have another question for you. On 9th Street, on the Humpley Bumpleys up there?
Yes.
That was a project the city wanted to do for Humpley Bumpleys, for, what do you call them?
Speed tables.
Speed tables.
Speed tables, not speed. They wanted a speed table.
Speed hump.
Speed hump.
Speed bumps, yeah.
Speed table is $90,000. Speed hump is $3,800.
Mm-hmm.
So, but they did two because they finally realized that two of the humps they wanted to put in, I should have kept my mouth shut because they would have put them in on County Road.
Right.
Should we be putting our two humps in on that?
Beacon?
On 9th.
On 9th.
Second hump?
We would not be in support of them. Okay. Given their impact to the road around it and what we see as not a great traffic calming device, they're just...
Well, it's sure that we had... Those two kids got killed up there. One kid got killed up there.
Right.
And it definitely slows people down.
Oh, yeah. And with a hill like that, yeah. And that's certainly part of it. But
young friends of mine, they got killed out on Dow Road on a motorcycle.
We've had four deaths in the last couple weeks in Illinois Valley. And we're not having them on 9th Street anymore. Yeah. It's in the city. The city dealt with their side.
Right.
I think there's some other traffic concerns that are... We've had more fatalities in the Illinois Valley than anywhere.
And we can revisit the speed bumps and see what the most recent studies show, because you obviously have the concern with motorcycles hitting them as well going down. But I think it's a pretty narrow application when you want to use them. You wouldn't want to use them on a 45-mile-an-hour road to get down to 20.
Someone who lives in the neighborhood where they're surrounded by them, I can tell you I hate them. 10th Street, Beacon, 9th Street.
But work. They keep people slow. Especially in a work truck, if you've got all that stuff.
See how much you can knock out the back, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so the next one, 5-year vehicle acquisition plan. So this has been kind of a bit in the making, but it's also been a matter of trying to just get caught up from years of deferred maintenance. And the bigger global plan, you remember, was to move our light and medium class vehicles to a more frequent turnover to get them in the manufacturer's warranty, to increase that reliability. We also were at a point where we were just losing money on county cars because they were just depreciating sitting there because they weren't driving enough. So we've pushed out that minimum miles. You're going to get built X amount a month, whether or not you drive it. That focused a lot of cars getting turned back in. We're pretty well right-sized now with how many rigs are out there. So what we've got now is this 5-year forecast, and I have to say Ted and Lori have done yeoman's work crunching this thing out. We look ahead to say, hey, we know that car the building safety has is going to drive X number of miles a year. Based on that, it's going to get 120. It's going to hit 60,000 miles. It, 2023, you got to replace it. So that's how we project forward how many vehicles per year we think we're going to need. On the right hand side, then the revenue. That's how much we can project we'll bring in based on that depreciation payment, if you will. So if you've got that car, each month you pay a minimum mileage charge or a charge based on how much you drive. The goal being over the next few years was to build up a bit of a fund balance because this fund's been rated for years and years and years. We're running around with a $2.5 million fleet and, $50,000 in the bank. That doesn't make any kind of accounting sense. So What this is showing is after the 5 years we've got listed here, we would have a cash balance projected of about $500,000. And in meeting with Arthur, he likes the plan. There's not an industry standard to say you got to have 20% of your fleet value, you got to have 15%, but this feels about like a good number. You know, there's no magic to it. If 50 cars blew up in a year, it's not enough retained. If we didn't have a car blow up for 2 years, it's too much. But this gets us to a point where that fund is financially strong. We were concerned we'd actually have to take out a loan of some kind, but Arthur's worked his magic and moved some things around, and we're basically to where we're going to have that $500,000 at the end. You'll notice that first year we show a negative $32,000, so this initial year it could be close, and if that's the case, he would do an interfund loan just within that capital reserve because there's a bunch of money in the building side, but it's effectively not considered an overage because it's got multiple cost centers in there.
So 8 cars for the sheriff's office. Sheriff's been buying off of... He's been buying off of federal re-scuttled.
Yes, he's used that for some of his, correct, right.
Is that on our maintenance costs and our replacement costs if we're going just off of auction and getting cars that have 100,000 or 150,000 miles on them to start
those with? Are a direct build, and those would not be part of the standard program. So like the 8 you would see here, those are going to be patrol rigs, which would fall under the usual model. And, if, you know, that's... We've worked with him quite a bit. If he finds something he thinks is a reasonable risk or a good car to buy used, and he wants to treat it as a direct bill, we don't argue with him. So if one of those ones he buys from the Forest Service, whatever, breaks down, he's on the hook for the maintenance cost for that. And there's no expectation that it will be replaced when it does.
I'm curious on that. What kind of vehicles are they purchasing for patrol? The city had CIS make a recommendation that they go to more SUVs because of knee injuries. Are we looking at the same thing?
Sheriff's has been moving almost exclusively to Tahoes.
Okay.
Yeah, that seems to be the new industry standard.
You say patrol vehicles, it could be any vehicle. It's not just a squad car.
Correct. Yeah, vehicles they're using for that every day, you know, the guys out running their patrolling function.
But said he looked at lowering injuries of officers because of going to the higher vehicles, not having to climb out of them anymore.
Climb into something low, presumably.
Right. Yeah. Jump out instead of fall in.
Mm-hmm. I always get, here we are in little old Grants Pass in Josephine County, and we went through Chargers, and now we're into Tahoes and stuff, and I watch enough live PD. And they're still driving Crown Vics.
Right.
We don't, because we're better than that. But the rest of the world's still driving Crown Vics. Because they were a darn good patrol car.
Mm-hmm.
But we're not. We have to have.
And I don't remember what the status of the Crown Vics is. I believe they fully discontinued them.
They don't make. You can't buy them. Every time. They won't buy them for 15 years.
Yeah. And... Yeah, you also get into if the sheriff says we've got a need for something to handle some off-road activity. That's kind of a programmatic decision. We say, all right, you tell us the kind of
need you have
for
a car. We have some four-wheel drive stuff in the wintertime. We have some situations that Crown Vic isn't going to handle.
Right.
So I'm okay with it, but it's just it's interesting that we can't do that.
And I only brought up the sheriff's office because I saw there's 8 vehicle purchases, and the last vehicles he's been getting off of the federal kind of process. Yeah. But then we don't have this... I always remember them saying, we need to keep these vehicles high maintenance because of the risk and the liability and all that other kind of stuff. But then when we're buying used versus new, what is the better outcome?
It depends on what you can get. If you get the Forest Service is getting rid of something that's got 70,000 miles on it, and it's an old Tahoe of some sort, those go a quarter of a million miles without having to do anything. When the engine blows, it's gone. Then it's scrap iron. But they only paid $5,000 for a $35,000 rig, get another $100,000 out of it, run it until she drops.
Right.
That's why he's saying that where the public works is, and fleet is not on the hook for when it quits. When it quits, you got what you got out of it.
And we do try to get our mechanics involved early on in that acquisition to make sure that we're getting that the sheriff is getting a reasonable product. And years ago, they got, I think it was 8 Crown Vics from Marietta County.
Just an assessment of it?
Yeah, 8 of them for $26,000. That should have been the first red flag. We got them up here, and, you know, 6 of the 8 dropped the transmission in the first year. Mm-hmm. What a surprise. So we try to get our mechanics out there to put eyes on these things to say, well, it might look like a good deal, but we're going to be seeing it sooner than we need to.
I needed to up my fleet by 4 rigs, and I went up and bought phone company vans. because they're well maintained. Every 3,000 miles, they're changing the oil in them. They weren't all beat up. Had fairly good tires on them, and
but
I bought them all.
The policy should not be the same for a standard vehicle purchase when you have people in custody, or you're in pursuit, or you're doing other things.
Well,
like
that's
that.
Why
that's
I think
a
that's
higher wear and tear on vehicles than the standard person should be driving.
Right.
The 8 vehicles, I think, are the Tahoes, and you bet you're going to put a guy in the back. You're going to need a cage and all the other stuff in there. Mm-hmm.
You just don't want to break down when you have somebody in cuffs.
Exactly. So. And that's the harder part also to convince, previous boards and some citizens to say, why do you have to keep buying new rigs? Well, if that breaks down, it does a lot more than if you break down, it's an inconvenience getting to work. If they break down with a trustee and they're just trying to get to a court, it creates a lot of ripple effects.
You bet.
So.
Well, I think the program is
not as
where
bad
it
as leaving your pet in the car.
It's given us a whole lot better reliability. We can promise to our customers, and it makes the county fleet look more professional, quite frankly. Mm-hmm. Next one, so the beacon widening. I missed my bolding on there. This is at about probably the 30% stage. We've been working with the property owners up there. We're down to now saying, hey, we think these trees may have to go. We think we can keep these trees. Can we get an easement to get on there to fix your driveway so it doesn't have a big kink in it? But that thing's moving along. We got a letter out to GPID 2 weeks ago, and you got CC'd on that just to kind of say, look, we're going to be opening this thing up. Here's a timeline. If you have designs on fixing that cross court, that's a great time to do it because it'll be cheaper for both of us. So they're going to be in the loop on that early on with the pre-cons and everything
else. I don't
want
to fix it. I told Don Miller I want it replaced.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't fix it.
Yep. And the one right below that Highland is going to be the same situation. We sent them, and I said handed on there. I lied. There's not a handout yet for that one. Highland is going to be a similar situation. There's a cross culvert up on Woodbrook area that's literally got holes like this. We actually laid it open the other day and just put some temporary culvert patches on top. But same thing. When that gets opened up for the sidewalk project, we want that cross culvert fixed so we can button it up for 20 or 30 years.
Yeah.
The Highland project, that's also about 30% level. We've got Rogue Civil doing design on that one. I'm hoping I'll have something to probably for public presentation next month. This is going to be a great one, though. It's basically from Cook on the south in there where that church just closed. That's actually kicking off here soon, too. We just saw a tentative design on that. Up to the Vine Highland intersection, so we'd infill the rest of the sidewalk.
Wow. The sidewalk, as you get up towards St. Clair up there,
yep.
It's only this wide.
Not anymore.
Okay.
Been up there a while? Oh, yeah, we hammered those photinias. That's Wade Elliott's hedge break. A couple weeks ago.
Okay, yeah. That's been a month or so. Yeah. I thought, that is not a sidewalk.
Yeah, we tried to not go all the way, because I think if we buzzed them all the way back to the back edge of sidewalk, there'd be nothing left. But, yeah, the photinia, if you turn your back, just keeps
now, there's quite a bit of development going up there. Is the developer paying for the sidewalks in those areas?
Yes.
Okay, all right. So we're just infilling what they...
Infilling, like where the trailer park is, places that are never going to go. That's what we're going to be looking to.
Is that within the city limits? Are we turning that over?
The top end is not quite in the city limits, I don't believe. And I'm hesitating because I think there is still one corner that's not. But
well, I was up across where Highland butts into Vine.
Yep.
Right next to Sharp Starf that I own 2751 up there. And we were in the county, but we were just out of the city.
Yeah,
we were in the county.
And I can't remember if the last UGB pushed it out to that point. But, yeah, between that church one, if that kicks off, and that bigger one that's finishing up, at least the sidewalk portion on the west side, we're saving actually quite a bit of what we thought we were going to have.
We get all done with the sidewalk up there, is there any plans to pave that all the way up and finish it off and be done with it?
Oh, yeah, we will. Okay. Pave and restripe and, just tighten everything up. Because
there's
a lot
of stuff that's going to the ground up there.
It's in bad shape, for sure. Lower River Road, the jurisdictional exchange. Check is no longer in the mail. Came in a day or two ago, so that's good news. For the last couple of months, operations have really been just hammering the vegetation out there, and we feel like we've got it probably about 80% of where we like to see our roads. It was ridiculously overgrown. We've got it beat back to where it's close. This fall, as I'm saying here, we'll focus on ditch maintenance and the culvert flushing. I think we're going to be able to just with that alone is going to fix a lot of the drainage stuff you see out there. It won't fix it all, but... it's going to improve a lot.
Have you started shooting elevations out there on those two corners and become the Lake Geneva, both ends of it?
Have not yet. I think we're going to get
that. Because I think that would be, now that we've taken that over, the spotlight's on us. Mm-hmm. We can't just say, nah, that's owed up, and they're not going to do anything about it. It is ours now, and I think if we could get in there and fix those two deals there with a culvert underneath it to stabilize both sides so it doesn't build up on one side and not the other.
Right.
and fill that thing in, I think we'd be miles ahead with the people that live out there.
Mm-hmm. That's a high priority for us. And we've already heard quite a bit from the folks out there anecdotally saying, hey, man, it looks a lot better out here. This feels a lot safer. I mean, it's kind of a surprise. Like, what's going on now? It wasn't our road. And we're looking at, we may end up chip sealing this next summer. Now that we've put it into our model, and we can kind of run that against other similar roads to see what it looks like. Herbicide protocol, I wanted to have a quick general discussion. Commissioners Fowler and DeYoung were with me at Williams last week. We had a robust discussion. We are coming at this from opposite ends of the spectrum, but we're aware of the concerns that are out there.
That deal, that steam machine thing that what's his name was bringing out there, that looked more, just looking at it, looked like something that you would use if you had a parking lot or a long driveway, a private thing. Do they make a commercial rendition of that?
I think that was it. It has a cone about that big. Well, from the research we've done.
It just had golf cart tires, golf cart wheels on it, so I'm going to assume it's not the commercial side, but can you get a hold of somebody? Because it seemed to me, in watching it, if we had one of those and you went out there and tried it, and it had a nozzle on it this big, and you killed back this far off the side of the road, you're home free. Now, you haven't done your bar ditch yet or anything of that sort, but at least if that wouldn't come back, you know, for a couple of years, maybe we
haven't found a model that we thought was going to be even remotely cost effective or time effective to operate.
It's just a big steam cleaner.
Exactly. And there's truth to it. If you walk outside with a pot of boiling water and you dump it on the ground, you're going to have a dead spot in your grass. And that's undeniable. It's just a question of how far and how fast can you get with that.
Right. I'm assuming it.
And what happens next year and 3 years from now.
Right. And a lot of that stuff looks neat, but, you know, they had that kind of that large spinning head that had the four tassels on it that would spin. I mean, that thing would break down every 2 feet. You'd have to have a box this big of those fiberglass tassels. So, you know, we're continuing to look, and I've got a report I'm preparing for you. It's kind of cool having the no spray area because we do have an apples to apples comparison out there. We know what 30 miles of spray looks like. We know what 30 miles of no spray looks like, and we're projecting those numbers out countywide because we already kind of have that. We've got
years
of data.
But you can't ignore what Mr. Jackson's doing out there and his group. I mean,
they're doing a
good job, but there isn't enough of them, and they're volunteers, and volunteerism wears off real quick when you're out there. You're the same 12 guys show up every weekend.
You need
and everybody else goes
50
by.
I reached out to Commissioner Lane County about their no spray program that they had done, and they had to go back to spray because they had some unintended consequences
in some areas. Yeah. Right, limited.
It's selective, but
they have to be intentional about they didn't just get to do an all or nothing on any of the programs. They had to be responsive in different areas.
Mowing actually
spreads some of the weeds. The weeds that it was spreading were poisonous to livestock. And so it was having an unintended consequence of actually causing harm. And in an agriculture area where they're wanting to maintain agricultural area. It was, so I just recommend that we learn from what else has been done and try to see what we can do to accommodate. But
it's interesting because, yes, both sides, them and us, I will say, you hold up the Lane program as an example. They hold it up and say, see, here's how it works. We're looking at saying they've got 9 flail mowers and they spend $1.3 million a year in mowing. There will be a lot more discussion, but I will be excited for you all to see our projected cost, blowing that out countywide, and I guess some answers to some of the questions that were raised out there.
Yeah.
Road bridge. So this one's, it's kind of a small one, but it's a cool one, and I thought it was important that you kind of see here's what happens when it works correctly. So road bridge goes north off of South River Road. This has been a historical problem issue. To borrow a phrase of one of my three favorite commissioners, it's flatter than a cow's face out there, I believe is the term. Yes, yes.
It's steeper than a cow's face.
Dang it!
Right. Flatter in the back of your head.
Okay, there, that's the one. Dang it, that's close. Effectively everything is moving south to north in this area, and our long-term drainage plan calls for 3 cross culverts to go across the road there, which looks all fine and good, but there's already a ton of water moving that way. And this is actually what our study showed would happen in a 10-year flooding event all this passive going around. But you can see where Rogue Ridge, everything that's blue there is underwater. And we've seen that in bigger events. They'll end up with 12 inches of water in that cul-de-sac down at the end. It's mind-boggling.
Well, and was it you, Dan, that met with those family out off the South River because we were having so much issues with flooding and runoff?
Yeah, a couple years ago. What are then, the follow-up would be is if those culverts are put in, you can see it all turns yellow, which means no flooding anymore, which is cool. The tough part being on that first piece I gave you, it gets to the end of that cul-de-sac with nowhere to go. Well, just recently, the guy that owns that parcel said, hey, I'm good granting a drainage easement, getting it the heck out of here. So we are going to do a kind of a cooperative agreement
where
we're
going to put a ditch down through there and go. Yeah.
You got it. So we are going to pay for...
There's a ditch going almost all the way down there.
On the west side of the West Houses.
Where if you go over here, South River Road, Ridge Road is, the water was coming down here and it was flooding this guy's garage out. But there was a ditch all the way down here.
Yeah.
That needed to be it's cemented in here.
Yep, and it carries minimal volume. We can't counter it for much. We're going to try and focus on that west side of the west part. You can actually see there's a pond at that last house there at the end.
If you get the rogue drive thing done, that should take care of some of that.
And that poor guy is the oldest house there, and he's the lowest house. Everybody else brought in all kinds of fill dirt, and so now this poor guy is stuck in the hole.
This guy between on, what is it, Jim's
Riffle, yeah.
That guy there, I said, you're building a hole.
Yeah.
And he says, well, you know, I didn't know. And I said, when you bought the place, did you look across the street?
Yeah.
Look across the street here. I said, what do you see? Cattails. I went,
yeah, jackpot. What do you think? That's
the case. You're living in a swamp.
Yeah.
But he did have a situation.
It's tough.
That's good. I like that.
And again, so what we're looking at doing is we would pay for, we'll get the engineering done, the survey, and drop the easements and all that in-house. We could even look at helping them with, if they want to pipe it, potentially. We don't know if the guy wants to leave it open, but one of those two ideas. But all the property owners showed up. We're very close to all of them. And they got the concept that, hey, this drainage ditch to the west, we can't touch that. That's now private property, so y'all have to make a point of maintaining this once we're done. But, you know, it's a good collaborative project. It fixes a problem for a lot of people, but it also kind of puts a spotlight on this is a common occurrence for us. People say, your water is getting here. No, it's not. The county road system does not redirect water. We're just keeping it as close to the natural historical pathways as we can. But the problem is you get building infill upstream, so you got more coming through, and we literally have places where people have built their house right in front of, hey, there's a drainage coming right through you. The county, there may be a culvert there, but that water's come there for 1,000 years, so we'll help you as much as we can, but this is not, quote, our problem.
Is there anything that any hurdle we have to jump to just go down there and run a ditch right into the Rogue River?
We're looking. Not sure. And that may change depending on if it's a pipe versus a
just
kind of a spill, right? We're looking at that part, yeah.
Okay.
Do not have a good answer for you on that part yet.
Okay.
But all in all...
I need to get it all done and then...
Exactly, yeah. Whoops, yeah.
Florida Department of Fish and Wildlife
can't do that, right? So we're excited. I mean, it's one of those. It's been a long-term nagger. Every time it gets a big rain, these folks call and say, what the heck, what are we going to do? Last couple, Safe Routes to School, the Williams Elementary School application, they got the grant award. It was done without a whole lot of input from us or the school, and we both kind of looked and said, this is not a very great application for the pedestrian path. So we're looking at see if we can't tweak it a bit to make the improvements closer there to the school, flashing lights, fix that intersection to slow folks down. So we've got a meeting with kind of all the players for next week. It could involve Public Works putting in a bit more. The initial match was $50,000 of the $205,000. We may end up having to be about $70,000, but we'd be a far better project to fix that entire intersection as opposed to a separated pedestrian path that really is going to be barely used, if at all. So I think we can get there on it. And then the last couple, we've got a couple of smaller safety enhancement type projects we want to do. One of them is at Fruitdale School, and if you know the area, there's roads coming from every dang angle. It's probably about our busiest school area we got. So we're looking at getting some of the date and time actuated flashers like they've got for Highland. So
basically, this is South, though, not
Fruitdale. I'll get that one next. For Fruitdale, it would be those lights. So you can basically at the start of your say, hey, we want those on this day from these times. Just program it and let it go. For South Middle, bit more of a holistic treatment. We would be looking at the intersection there immediately north of it there. So the Liberty, Grandview, Two of those legs are ours. Two are the city's. We would propose splitting the cost in this 50-50. This would involve actually doing either the RRFBs or those same flashers, doing a continental crosswalk treatment. But this just, it really needs to be enhanced because the kids that end up going that direction end up stranded on a bit of an island there. But I would, even if we went with the RRFBs, I could see this being a $40,000 to $50,000 project that we would chop 50-50. And that seemed fair to everyone, with each of us having two of the four legs at the intersection.
But didn't they decide to move south to over by Redwood?
I don't know if that's... Yeah, it's
they're going to maybe keep it as a specialty school as well if they did do that.
Okay. It'd so become, the investment would be worth doing no matter...
If it came to that, I guess on the backside of me, look, we could probably take the RRFBs out or the port and make sure that they were... That's a good point. Make them more portable if it came to that. I think we would still... Those, the crosswalk and everything else, there would be a good treatment even if there was no school. But, yeah, good thought to keep the lights more portable if South moves in two, 3, 4, 5 years. Yeah.
You know you're getting old when all the schools you attended are being torn down.
Right.
Repurposed into something else. Oops.
My elementary school's gone. My high school's gone.
Oh, my high school's gone.
My kids, high school's gone. My kids have had at least three people I went to school with teach them, and one of them, Ken Berg, he was my teacher, and he was actually one of my kids' sub-teacher. He's still kicking around a little
he's
bit.
Still
is he
really? Teaching?
Subs a little bit, yeah.
Wow. Yeah, he was my math teacher at North.
Yeah, he subs for social
and
studies.
And he graduated high school with my dad, which is just kind of funny, too.
Well, then he's still a young man.
Well, yeah, when you're going through your dad's yearbook, and you're like, oh, that's my teacher.
Okay.
All right.
Is that it?
That's all I got.
Good report.
I got a request. So we had a citizen complain about that vehicle that was out in the middle of nowhere this weekend.
Yes.
And it turned out it was a juvenile vehicle, and they had kids out on a field trip, which is what they do with the kids that are in the residential program sometime. But Search and Rescue was also doing a rescue training operation in the area, and they had contacted Sheriff's Dispatch to try to see who the vehicle belonged to, and Sheriff's Dispatch did not have a list of county vehicles, even though it had a county number on it and all this kind of stuff. So is that something we can make sure that we keep current with dispatch?
Yep.
It might not be a bad idea to make sure both dispatches have that information just for the sake of if something were to happen with the county. It's got a county logo on it. Well, whose is it? So we can track her down.
Yeah. Tough, but we do have a handful of vehicles that don't have badging or numbering by request of departments for safety reasons, but we could at least, we can get them a list of plates and all that. So,
yeah.
Okay.
Well, and this one has a county logo on the side.
Yes.
So there's no...
Most of them do.
There's no... If they definitely have a county logo, there's no reason why we don't have some numbering that we can identify who that vehicle belongs to. And in this case, for some reason, they said it just said 101. I don't know that we would ever have a three-digit number because that's not how we've done our numbering system. We always have the year of the vehicle, a letter, and the numberings.
Yes.
And so, anyhow, I just know that Sheriff's Office deputy had responded to my inquiry saying that she had been on the radio trying to find out because they came across it in their trainings and also couldn't find out. So.
Okay. Yeah, we can make a point of getting them a list on an annual basis.
Thank you, sir.
Cool. All right.
Thank you.
You good?
So the next agenda item, I'm going to hijack a little bit. Number three is permission to use vacant lot parking lots around the courthouse for fair patrons the week of fair.
I think we got that changed.
We got a solution that is different than needing to do that. So the LDS Church on the corner of Harbeck and Williams Highway is offered to be the parking for shuttling, and worked with Grants Festival District for South to be the overflow for there. So Transit will provide the shuttling from there, so it stays on that south side of the river. It's someplace known enough that you can say this is it, and you don't have to try to find it.
Right.
And is not utilized to the point in the daytime that...
It's only a few blocks.
Yeah, right. Shortens the bus ride.
Yeah, you can go out.
Yeah, and be more often. And,
as soon as you pull out Allen Creek, you can take West Harbeck over and you're there. Yeah.
So there are some... The church requested certain areas not be parked in. South is the same thing that we got to work with their admin because they're back. But either way, it'll still provide several hundred parking spots that are easily located. So that solution was found after... I happened to call Tamara on something else that had come up, and I said, is there anything else we can do? Do you need me to sweep somewhere or shovel something? And and she goes, well, this just happened. And I'm like, you want me to make some phone calls? So anyhow, we were able to find a solution there. So.
Excellent.
Item number four is the Ann Basker application for Grace Roots. Annette was able to come up with our staff a schedule of rentals last year. Greaseroots paid one rental fee for three dates. I'm not sure how in their reservation it worked for three dates and the one reservation fee, or if that's something special we worked out with that. But the other groups in the community that use it, Rogue Valley Association of Realtors, they paid full cost for rental. There was another community meeting from an unknown group. They paid a higher rate. The chamber paid for the first candidate form. We waived the second one. So as far as that goes, I don't know what you guys want
to do. I recommend, because it's a Saturday, and we've got to probably make arrangements to have somebody come out and check to make sure that they got it locked up and so on and so forth. I'd say half. I'd just stick with the policy that says for...
They already are at half per policy.
Then that's...
So you're saying half the policy or half as the policy says?
What is it? $350?
$175
is the minimum for profit. It's 75. $150 is 75. I said leave it at 75.
The problem is we say a minimum 2 hours or something like that, so it would be $150. And that's fine, because if staff have to come out on a special day to check a building and stuff like that, I don't know what the procedure is, or if we figured out with facilities what the procedure is for a rental of a building on a weekend. But so as it stands right now, for a normal organization, it'd be $150 an hour, minimum 2 hours, so that's $300 minimum.
Right.
For a nonprofit, we cut that in half to $75 an hour, but minimum 2 hours, so $150.
So it'd be $1.50, and if it was a Thursday or a Friday or a Wednesday or something when we're at normal business hours, I would say that's fine. But because it's on Saturday, I think it really kind of needs to be something.
Yeah, and I don't want to start picking favorites, because then everybody else will get in line for the same discount. And the Saturday thing does play into it, but I still think I don't want to pick winners and losers.
So we just stick with the current policy as is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. Unless we want to change the policy. Yep.
And we can have facilities make a recommendation down the road, or have Annette work with facilities to come up with a recommendation.
They can get a sponsor for that $100.50 from somebody if they could.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know what the situation is exactly. I just wanted to make sure we looked at what else has been out there.
Yeah.
It looks like we gave them a discount last year and that they got three nights for the price of one. So there was something that we worked out with them last year that in one reservation they got three nights and we only charged them. But those were also,
right.
I don't know.
Again, that's cheating. I think it should be fair.
Would you like me to contact them?
We need to respond to their application request, so I don't have an opinion. I just think we should have a policy and stick to it.
And
if we
stick
need
to
it,
it.
The policy, we go from there.
Exactly.
So we got an email from the Applegate Neighborhood Watch Formation. They're looking at doing that. So last night she emailed last week. I said I'd bring it to our next meeting today. Debbie Grady is a name we should know, because she's been one of the ones that has been behind a lot of the discussion about cougars. I don't know if that picks a memory, but anyhow, they sent a letter yesterday to be brought into our conversation today. And basically it says, on July 28th, 18 residents of Josephine County attended a meeting at the home of Andrea Applegate on New Hope Road to discuss following concerns impacting our neighborhood. These issues deserve the attention of our county commissioners. I should have brought it up while Rob was still here, because I forgot it was coming up. Problems: repeated trespasses along New Hope Road between the Applegate River Bridge on State Route 238 and the Applegate Golf Course. Inattention by County Public Works to transient activity at the county pit. So neighboring Miss Applegate's property, in between her property and the golf course is the county's public works yard there.
Right.
And so they said, during the past several months, a number of property owners located along Applegate River in the Murphy area have been confronted by trespassers. Intruders are causing particular alarm to single elderly residents who live in the widely spaced homes in its neighborhood. In one instance, a trespasser was sleeping on private property carrying a weapon and tools commonly used to break into locked buildings. Three residents have either reported these encounters by telephone to the county sheriff's office or filed verbal reports in person with sheriff's office personnel. On two occasions, sheriff's deputies have responded with on-site investigations of these complaints. These law enforcement visits are appreciated, however, the trespassing problem persists. To assist in identifying and reporting trespassers, property owners have stated patrolling a 3,000-foot section of the Applegate River dike between the Murphy Ditch Diversion Dam and the downstream end of Onion Creek, southeast corner of the county pit. This neighborhood watch is having some success. A resident on Southside Road noted a transient camp on the county pit near the Applegate River. This encampment may harbor trespassers that threaten homes in the area. County Public Works needs to remove any campsites at the county pit and discourage such illegal use of public property. Transient campfires could get out of control and engulf surrounding properties. Our wish is to inform the commissioners of the problem with trespassers in a rural area of the county and need improved property management on the South County Pit. They specifically, the first email was on Thursday the 1st, and they asked, they are next having a meeting on Saturday, August 17th at 1 p.m.
During the fair?
Fair week. And they're asking for us to tell them which commissioner will be representing the board at their meeting. And so I said I would bring it up today, but they are asking for a commissioner to attend. Quite honestly, to me, this seems to be something that would be appropriate for the resident deputy to attend on a community neighborhood watch, but it's involving the County Public Works pit and the impact on the neighbors surrounding it. So I just said I'd bring it up today and that we'd get back to them on. So their request is to let me know if you can attend and which commissioner will represent the board so that I can advise our group at 1 p.m. on the 17th. So,
well, Public Works, Public Safety.
Sheriff.
No. Sheriff is him too.
Sheriff.
I'd see the fingers. And I don't mind going and doing it, but I don't have my schedule in front of me.
True, and I don't know what our commitments are fair week because we all signed up.
It's fair week because we're signed up for different shifts on there. And
yeah.
But I'll have to find out what it is.
Well, and
if I'm free, I'll go out there.
And if you can't make it, I'll go. I went to the Neighborhood Watch meeting in Maryland a couple months ago, and I thought it was productive. But this one has... Let me know if you can't go ahead of time so I can get with Rob and see about the pit and the transient.
And honestly, I've been out there and walked the property, took pictures of the pit, did the drainage ditch and all that other kind of stuff. So I've already been out there and talked with Miss Applegate. You've gone out there and talked to Miss Applegate. It might be a good one for you to be exposed to it just so we're all on the same page.
Careful.
You can't smile when you say that.
Pick your
words.
And
you know I'll go to any meeting anytime. So
yeah.
You can count on me.
Pick your word.
All right, so we'll let her know that somebody...
somebody will be there.
Okay, and maybe... I don't know what schedule-wise, but we can respond to the email that
we'll
let her know. So,
yeah, okay. Just let me know. I'll go back.
The next one is Advisory Board Agenda Distribution Instructions. I guess they're, at some point... the advisory board's distribution and notification of the public kind of fell on the department heads. And they had a manager meeting a couple months back, and they're like, well, let's just all give it to JPR and have him set up the distributions. And what I'm finding is some departments send it to us and expect us to send it out. Others maybe send it to I. But there's not a consistent distribution. And what I have noticed is no matter who is hosting a wish department or anything else at the city, I get notifications from one person at the city. And it's city admin that sends out the notifications for all city advisory boards and meetings.
I think that's appropriate.
And so I think it should be our office that sends out all the notifications. And we need to come up with a procedure of departments must have them to our staff no later than this much time before the meeting.
72 hours or whatever.
So that we can get them out before the 24 hours notification. If there's specialty groups that need distribution, they can provide that to us. One of the things I've asked for in our website design, there is there's a specific module that allows us to build an agenda, and electronically we can put all the questions in we need for an agenda item, and the department head would simply, for our meetings, for say, for these items, the department head would put the title in there and the details of what needs to do, and it sends it over, and we either can send it back and say, well, I need more information about this, or, okay, great, schedule, and it'll get it scheduled. It'll automatically go on an agenda, and we can do a notification, and those agendas get sent out. So there's this program that was created, and talking to our website people, it's not the company we chose for the website, but one of the ones that bid on our website created this module, and they say it's the best in the nation, and we recommend you use their program. And so I've told John we need to have that program so we have a consistency on agendas and all this other kind of stuff and the notifications.
Well, and I like when stuff comes through one point because then it looks the same going out as well.
Correct.
Don't have different departments formatting it differently. And
oh, we still have that.
But we could clean that up.
That's
if it
true.
Came through this office or but came through
of,
that website.
Part of it is with that website, but that, our website's not going live till October. So that's one of those things that...
Right.
But in the meantime, as far as distribution, it hasn't seemed to work to send out several emails to department heads saying, make sure these people are on your list, because they're all like, well, I thought you, you know,
right.
this guy sent it out. It's like, that's not his job.
No, I think it needs to go the other way. It's coming this way. Mm-hmm. It just makes sense.
I think one of the things that they keep asking for also, the public does, is for a little more detail in the agenda as far as items that are going to be talked about.
Correct.
Just a little more definition as to what it's going to be rather than
the simplest possible.
What does public works come in and talk about?
Annette is on now the website committee. She's one of a very small handful of people that is on that. And so we'll be speaking to what that agenda builder needs to say and ask. And she's working with Pat because Pat has the details of when we used to provide more information. And so
right.
they're going to be working together to make sure that that has that, if that's okay with you guys.
I think that's really good.
The next item is the Billy Williams Marijuana Summit. So we got an email. I don't know who all it went to, but the U.S. Attorney, the U.S. Assistant Attorney General for Oregon, Billy Williams, sent out an invitation to his next Marijuana Summit, which is Thursday, September 5th. I emailed him back and I said, who do you intend to be there from Josephine County? And his response is, well, last time it was you, Commissioner DeYoung, and the sheriff, so let me know who's coming. He didn't really say who he wanted there. And I didn't know if you got an invitation and the sheriff and I all got invitations again. But I figured since he said for us to let him know.
I'm going.
I figured you were going to go.
Yeah.
I did not know if Commissioner Fowler, if you wanted to go.
Right. Are they talking about code enforcement and licensing laws and all that? Or are they talking about legal?
Says here.
What they talked about. Oh, go.
We'll
yeah,
be
go ahead.
On hand to discuss a variety of current and emerging issues related to marijuana legislation. Official
right.
invite with registration information and agenda are forthcoming due to space constraints. This is an invite-only event, and the registration will be required. Thank you for your participation.
Yeah, that sounds more like law enforcement than code enforcement.
Yeah, it well, it's any issues related to...
Right.
I thought we had a good robust. I
brought up health stuff. You brought up.
I didn't hear any. I only heard one or two solutions, and I said so at the summit. I said I thought we were here for solutions. All I've heard belly aching. You know, people telling you what your problem is. We all know what the problems are, for Pete's sake. And Carl Wilson had his 40% reallocation, and I had the Law Enforcement Stability Act. That was the only two solutions in the whole room. And, you know, so, but I think, you know, we've gone beyond that now and we've figured out that nothing's worked so far. I've got some information in my office as to what marijuana contributes. We keep saying, well, marijuana does this and we do this with our marijuana money, as if to the folks out here that we're getting this huge amount of money from marijuana. I compared it to timber, and I'll get those numbers to you. I shared it with Annette yesterday. It's stunning. It's staggering how much marijuana doesn't pay for. But yet they're all, oh, why, we're the economic driver of the whole Southern Oregon. And they're not. We don't even have a mill in Josephine County. And the amount of money we get from timber-related things is 8 times, 9 times what we get from marijuana total.
Well, and I had someone in my office yesterday, I think, asking what the county could do to help with a hemp processing plant. And
give you a location in Lake County because they need the work. Put it right next to the prison in Lake County.
No, they wanted us to focus on Kirby and Selma. But it was one of those things that I said, well, first off, who owns the property you're looking at? They would need to be on board. Who's got the development in the who's going to invest the business? I said they can potentially apply for an economic development grant and through So Ready, but the county is not about to go into business and compete with the private sector. But we can help with the process of the development code or the development permits and different stuff if you know somebody who wants to do
that. Well, I think we really need to have a voice at the table because some of that stuff is pretty darn dangerous. But depending on what their process is, that stuff can get borderline explosive.
So, well, and that was one of the fires that started in Jackson County this week was from a oil processing residence. And that ended up being that 300-acre Sam's Valley fire.
Do they get the bill for that?
I don't know if they got cited. I saw something that Department of Forestry did cite somebody on one of the fires.
So this one will stick with marijuana and not be about hemp, right?
Yeah, so Billy Williams, just so you know, he's been the one driving the conversation with the state of Oregon to curb out-of-state trafficking. And so I think the sheriff and Dan probably are the best representatives to go, if that's okay.
Yep.
Well, I met with him for 15 minutes over at Ashland, and we had just a one-on-one conversation, and he'd been very helpful.
We need to continue to look for solutions. Yeah. I know that we have that agenda. I will bring up the regional district meeting for the AOC coming up, and I put your agenda items back on there.
Okay, good.
But are there other things we need to be looking at? Are there other things coming up that we need to be aware of?
Well, I think, that's why I was asking Mark, where does hemp fall into it? And he answered my question. If you're not a licensed hemp grower, you fall under marijuana law.
Right.
So that you just made that connection there because that's what this is going to do also. Because all of a sudden it became, if you're not registered or licensed hemp grower, you just became an illegal marijuana grower, is what I heard
from Mark.
Mark, and so that would put it under this jurisdiction. I'm gonna make sure I've got all the wording right to take it when they go, oh, a hemp, we're just under the Farm Bureau. No, you're not unless you're registered. This is also working in with the deal I talked to Amanda Metzger as far as some sort of contribution to our law enforcement thing.
Do you want to reach out to the sheriff to see if he's able to go so we can make sure the RSVPs go?
And then we're RSVP.
And then Annette can help you with your RSVP since you got your own invitation. And I'll decline online, if that's okay.
Sounds good.
Saying no to a trip.
What? What's that?
I said I'm saying no to travel. On one.
What are they redoing all the stuff at Disney World or something? Is it closed for refurbishing or something?
I have no idea. It'll be years before
there's
I
Disneyland
go there.
In Portland?
You know, the only way I've ever gone to Disney World is I have family there, and so I got in for free.
Surprise, surprise.
Yeah.
You even got family in Florida.
I have family.
No, I have 3 generations of family that work at Disney World.
I'm watching the U.S. Open, and my daughter-in-law says, you know, Ricky Fowler's my cousin. Why didn't I know that?
No, who Ricky Fowler is.
He's a pro golfer.
Oh, got it. Sorry, I should
have. And a nice kid.
So moving on in the agenda to
great
additional
name.
Subjects and matters from commissioners. I have two. I realized I had asked if you could maybe attend Lipstick, but I'm thinking I need to be there because there's an agenda item that impacts.
Okay.
But I want to go by it with you guys. So... At the last LIPSC meeting I went to, I had an opportunity to talk to Judge Bain afterwards about the role of LIPSC in our county. Because really, there's two key roles in LIPSC that really can drive the success and that, and that's the presiding judge and the commissioner. By statute, the commissioner's office are the conveners of LIPSC. We appoint several of the positions, and then several of the positions are appointed by the presiding judge. And so those two pieces are kind of key. But ultimately, it's the commissioners that convene the meeting and are a voting member per state statute. Matter of fact, when we first started it, the commissioners were the chair of it as the convener. And different counties do it differently, but that's how, like, Marion County is kind of the example for the state. Multnomah County, theirs is pretty crazy. They have Billy Williams on their LIPSC. They have federal agencies on their LIPSC. It's not just the local public safety. Theirs kind of big time. But the whole idea is that we're bringing together the key people that talk about public safety and are impacted by and can make decisions for, and we're supposed to be looking out of our silos and working as a community, as a team. That's why the legislator formed the coordinating councils once upon a time ago, is because they realized it was a bigger picture. And the reason why the commissioners are there is we're the purse strings of all the county functions. We're a key partnership in public safety through the purse strings. There was a move a bit ago to create bylaws. They're not required for it, but the group looking at some of the other counties created bylaws, and they said, we want to take the commissioner's voting role away. And I raised my hand and said, you can't. Statutorily, it's given. You can't take away something state statute gives. And then they said, well, we don't want the commissioner to ever be chair or vice chair. And I said, well, I'm not going to support it going forward if you do that. Every year the group nominates the chair or vice chair. You don't have to nominate for the chair or vice chair of the commissioner. But don't take away a voting member's ability to be in that role.
Right.
And so it's one of those things that it's like, I'm not saying that the commissioner has to be in that role. I'm just saying don't take away the function of one of your voting members to be an equal part of the team that the state legislator has determined is a critical piece, that they're the convener and is the chair in several areas. So why would we say you can't? You just don't nominate is my way of dealing with that. My recommendation is that I said I don't support the bylaws moving forward so long as you're going after a legitimate voting member and the convener. If you take that portion out, that you're not restricting the commissioner's role on the committee, then I'll support your bylaws.
And not mandating it either.
Does anybody else have the authority to be the convener rather than the board?
No, by state law, we are the convener.
Okay.
And in several other LIPSCs, including Douglas County, our nearest county, the commissioner is the chair and all that role. So,
is that bylawed by them for a commissioner being chair, or just the way tradition has been?
Ours was created by an order back in the day, and ours started that way. And for 20 years, the commissioner was the chair. And at some point, a commissioner didn't want to be anymore, so we changed our orders.
Right.
And I don't have a problem with the commissioner not being.
No.
I have a problem with saying you can't.
But you don't want to take away the ability to be.
Correct.
Right.
I'm not trying to force the outcome, just that you don't take away the possibility.
I can back you on that.
They wanted an update on the bylaws because they recommended them to the board a year ago, and we never moved forward with them, so they've never been approved. And the reason I saw is because it's going counterproductive to what LIPSCs are supposed to be statewide. And I think I've been exposed more to what the LIPSCs could be because of my role as co-chair of the Public Safety Committee up at AOC. So we're getting LIPSC updates and LIPSC coordinators and all that other kind of stuff. So I'm seeing exposure to what others do. And the whole goal is that we can do more. And that's part of why I reached out to Judge Bain as well. And I said, I'd love us to make sure that we're doing everything we can as part of this LIPSC to support this community and to support the function. And how are we doing that right? And working together as a team and that role. So, you know, one of the things I advocated for 2 years ago was that Cave Junction have equal sitting at the table and asked for a city council member and a staff member, because the city had that with the mayor and the chief and different stuff like that. And I had people say, well, no, we're going to have quorum issues. I said, we only have two cities. Why can't they both be at the table?
No, and I think they're glad to be there.
And they are.
Yep.
They are glad to be there. But I, since that is a topic that's coming up on Thursday, I didn't want to hide that from you guys or let you know what my stance was on it. And make sure that if I'm going forward and saying what my stance was, that I threw that by you guys.
Backing the other two commissioners, or at least threw it by us.
Yes.
Like I said, I would back you.
So I have no problem with them doing their rotation. I just don't want them to preclude any member that's a voting member from.
Is that the only change that we want in there?
There was something about membership. I had an issue with them saying no public comment. I don't remember what they ended up with the wording, but they changed the seating so public kind of sits away from the table and different committees. I think every committee is kind of different. But then you have groups like the Illinois Valley Public Safety Alliance. Public Safety Task Force that is asked to be on the agendas, that is asked to be able to be a part of that conversation. And I don't remember what their outcome was about making that recommendation.
Still hasn't included it. Kate's still showing up, but...
Yeah, and it's they only will let her speak if she gets a hold of the chair in advance. And
is that what it is?
It's kind of one of those things that...
It seems like we ought to have the chair of that group at that table, but that just makes logical sense.
So that was the one other thing that I had heard from a citizen standpoint of a concern.
Yeah.
Their perspective was then any citizen organization can show up and say we want a fair chance to speak. And
like every neighborhood watch, or
have you rewritten what your requests are and taken it back to Lipstick and said, what do you think about this?
No, because I wasn't the Lipstick liaison anymore. Because we had a little hiccup there for a while of needing a timeout. So now that I'm back, this is the first time it's being brought up since I'm back as the liaison to Lipstick.
Well, so, I think if it's ever going to get passed, it needs to go to Lipstick and say, these are the things I'm concerned about. Do you have any?
Yeah.
These are the changes I'd like to see made. I brought it up to the board. Didn't get any objection, I guess, would be the way to propose it. And then just see if it runs by them. See if it flies with them and explain just like you explained us. I don't want to. We're not forcing our will on the board. But however, we don't want.
They're not required to have bylaws. They were created by board orders. They exist under that in state statute. The bylaws was something they thought they should create. But I don't necessarily know if I agree with the language of it that says their mission is that they're just an advisory to the commissioners. I don't think that's what the Lipstick is supposed to be.
Does the state say they're supposed to be? Is that the state's definition?
No. No.
Well, we've gone from just take, I think the only thing is that the commissioners can't be chairman. And now we're down to I don't know what the purpose of the Lipstick is.
Well, and I asked the judge to weigh in on that.
Mission statement, and there's more than one thing there. You need to write all those down. If it's going to be a complete revamp of the bylaws.
There are no bylaws approved by the board.
Right, but going to approve some bylaws by the board.
And they can send them back to the board to do it. The only thing that I absolutely said, I won't support these bylaws if you say the commissioner can't be in this role.
That
was the only thing I said. But I had asked the judge to look at the wording that they put in there, that they're only an advisory to the commissioners. Because I don't think they are. And one example of that is justice reinvestment dollars requires it to go through the Lipstick. It doesn't require it to get the permission of the board. It requires it to go through the Lipstick. So there's functions the state has given to Lipsticks that have nothing to do with the board. So I don't think they are just advisory to the board. There are things they can make recommendations to the board on.
What I'm trying to do is move forward on this thing. If we're going to have bylaws, write up what you think it should do. Get Judd Baines' take on what the changes that need to be done. Propose it to them and say, okay, what do you think? Then at the Lipstick, the whole group put their 2 cents worth in and get the bylaws written up.
Yeah.
Because we've had a big
turnover of who Lipstick is.
And that's fine. Maybe that's the time to settle out.
And I haven't heard back from Judge Bain on what his thoughts were on it.
I would wait to hear what Judge Bain's thoughts were on after he gives some time on it. But
I didn't put this on the agenda. Because there's a citizen that hasn't been there. Our citizen at large position hasn't attended in over a year. And I said, well, send a report to the commissioners and we'll advertise, we'll vacate it and advertise for, and they said, well, our bylaws don't say that. I said, well, they're appointed by the commissioners. The commissioners can unappoint them. It doesn't require bylaws to do that. But that's how it got on there, is because I had said that they need to report that this person hasn't attended for more than a year so we can get it filled by a citizen.
And there's a pretty good overview on the Oregon.gov website of the formation and the makeup. It's pretty explicit.
Well, and that's why the group themselves said we would like to come up with bylaws. I think it was partly because the LIPSIT coordinator was saying, well, what if other people do? Should we do this too? And I don't think the bylaws should put us backwards or limit us beyond what the state statutes allow. But anyhow, to say the least, I think I should go to LIPSIT on Thursday.
Sounds good.
Okay, then the other one was we got a letter from the Government Finance Officers Association saying we're being awarded Certificate of Achievement, an award of financing reporting achievement, and they'd like us to put it on an official agenda to receive that award. And do you mind if I just have staff schedule it at a weekly business session?
Yep.
Okay. And they want us to put out a press release and gave us an example press release, so we'll follow up with that.
Excellent.
Any other items of funness?
I'd like to introduce you, Chairman. This is Ben Heater. He's Dan Heater's son. And he's just he's very interested in politics, and he's going to follow me around for today. Maybe not a good mix.
Grandson.
There we go.
Yeah.
I'm like, wait
grandson,
a second.
Excuse me.
I know these kids, and they're older than you.
Yeah. Anyway.
Awesome.
Anyway, he's going to follow me around for today and then through the weekly business session tomorrow, and then he's off on his own.
Nice.
So I'm going to take him around and show him some departments in the courthouse, and then we're going to do a little field trip before the afternoon meeting. We do have an executive session on here talking with Fairgrounds Lease, so probably he would have to step out of the room during that.
Yes, or you can see if he can sign a confidentiality down the hall, but it would probably be better for
I just assume not have you, you know, because we're going to talk about a lot of commas and a lot of zeros, and it's just stuff you probably don't want to know. Okay?
Right.
So I remember you at the town hall, though. Mm-hmm. So thanks for being here. There was also a request from department head to, should we send out an official something from the commissioner's office announcing that Ned is here? And I think I just didn't even realize we didn't. And so thought I'd see what you guys think of that. Because
what did that look like? Just a memo?
Welcome Annette Sorensen, our executive office manager, began this week.
Send a picture of her. Annette. Hi, my name's Annette.
Yeah, kind of like an internal press release to the department heads.
That sounds really appropriate.
Okay. We'll work on that.
Yep.
Anything else?
None for me.
Oh, sweet. All right, so we can be adjourned at 11:02.
Back here at 2?